at home, I didn't question gender stereotypes at all. In fact, at home, I was on Stepford Wife autopilot. And my Stepford Wife autopilot was made even more complicated by the fact that I had a really bad case of something that I call HCD, home control disease. This is basically when you feel that everything under your roof should be done a certain way, which is basically your way. And it manifested in all kinds of small ways that actually amounted to something big.
That was Tiffany DeFoo, author, entrepreneur, and pioneer committed to advancing women and girls. And this is Best Breakouts from the Conferences for Women, an audio series that offers timeless insights from our archives to help you advance at work and in life. In this session, Drop the Ball, Tiffany DeFoo offers a progressive approach to address the division of labor in your home. Reevaluate your priorities and embrace imperfection so you can focus on the goals that truly matter. We hope you enjoy it.
I wrote Drop the Ball and then released it in February of this year. And a few weeks before the book came out on Valentine's Day, I got a phone call from my daughter's school. My daughter is in the third grade. It was about 3 p.m. It was a call from the school nurse. She was physically okay, but she was in the nurse's office crying uncontrollably. What had happened was that right after school, all of her friends had went off to a birthday party that she knew nothing about. And if you can remember being that young, it was absolutely devastating. Now, she had been invited to the birthday party. It's just that it wasn't on my calendar. It wasn't on my husband's calendar. So therefore, we didn't know about the party. I have to admit to you all that this is not the first time that this exact scenario has played out in my household, a child being upset because they missed a birthday party that wasn't on the calendar. Furthermore, I should also admit to you that I can always anticipate when something like this is going to happen, that there's something I could do to prevent this scenario from happening, but that I don't. I drop the ball. Now, before you start throwing tomatoes at me, because I must be a very evil person, certainly a very bad mother, what I'd like to do is spend some time taking you back in time to how I even got to the point where I could be standing here on this stage and telling you this story and not be riddled with guilt and even have a smile on my face. My life's work is advancing women and girls. That's pretty much why I'm on the planet. So my life, even despite that bio, is relatively simple. I know what's on my tombstone. And on most days, I'm just kind of project managing my life backwards. And I feel really lucky that I get to do that as chief leadership officer at Levo, as a public speaker, as an author, and on all of those nonprofit boards. For most of my career, I've been focused on what I feel is a really big problem, and that is of women in leadership. Most of you probably know that even though women are half of the population and that we enter the workforce in about the same rate that men do, that by the time we get to the C-suite, there are only about 18, 19% of us left, a few being Carol. She just referenced that. And by the way, this is across every sector of our society, not just in corporate America. In fact, there are only three sectors of our society where people will readily admit that they're not even ready for women in leadership. We call those guns, games, and God. In the military, there are people who will say, I'm not quite sure she should be on the battlefield. Games and sports, there are leaders who will readily say, I'm not quite sure she should be in the locker room. And God, we have religious leaders who will say, there are certain roles for men and there are certain roles for women. But despite those three areas, pretty much if you poll anyone, they will say, we think that women in leadership is a good thing. We think it's a positive thing and we're ready for women to lead. Despite that, this number of 18, 19% hasn't really changed. This is 2016. I dropped the ball on updating this slide. McKinsey and Lean In have a new report out. But ladies, it's the same basic number. We haven't changed in certainly the past 20 years. So we really haven't changed this equation. Sometimes people ask, Tiffany, why are you so obsessed with women and leadership? And that goes back to my childhood experience. I had a father who used to have what I now feel like are conspiracy theories about how there was this small group of elite people that ran the world. It was kind of like the man. Have you ever heard of the man? Except they were plural, so more insidious. And he would even say, they were kind of like the alternate universe of the Super Friends, you know, it's like that. And I would be really embarrassed when my friends would come over and they would warn, you know, you would warn us about these people. But over time, as I grew into my leadership and I started ascending myself, I started realizing that my daddy wasn't that crazy. Okay. There are, in fact, in most organizations, industries, rooms. And they look a little bit like this. You might be familiar with them. They have big wooden or marble tables. Sometimes they're glass. They usually have plush leather chairs. In tech companies, they may be white or something. People may have hoodies around them. But the people around these tables and these rooms that are largely sitting, usually on the top floor, the top suite of an office building, these are the people that are making decisions that impact every single one of us. And since certainly the founding of this country, the people who are occupying these seats are largely male. They're largely white. They're largely able-bodied and straight. And even though they may come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, by the time they're sitting in this seat, they're pretty much in the higher echelon. Now, I want to be really clear because I have a lot of rich white male friends and they're really cool. I love them. Okay. So it's not that there's anything against them. They usually have really great intentions. The challenge is that we have a lot of research now that shows that if you have a really tough problem that you're trying to solve, that having a more diverse group of people sitting around a table like this is going to lead you to a more innovative solution. And we have problems now that are tougher than ever before. It doesn't matter so much to me whether you care the most about education or healthcare or our economy or the environment or gender equality, which I think everybody should care about. What is important to keep in mind is that for any one of those issues, there are people sitting around the tables making decisions. And until we have more women in leadership, more people of color in leadership, more people with socioeconomic backgrounds that are more diverse and with different family backgrounds, that the biggest crisis we face is a crisis of leadership. I've been saying this for a long time. People like nod their head now, especially now when we say this, but it's a really, really difficult problem. And I think that it's time for us to finally solve it. For most of my career, I've been focused on what I call collective solutions to the women's leadership conundrum. Okay, so I've been a big proponent of equal pay for equal work, of public policies like affordable childcare, which working families really need in order for them to thrive. I've been a big proponent of things like workplace flexibility, okay, that allows people to be fully human, of cultures in which people can really bring their full selves to the table. This is largely what I spoke about and I talked about for most of my career. In 2013, I had a couple of experiences that caused me to think a little bit differently about this problem and led to me writing this book. One of those experiences was that I did a lot of public speaking in 2013 because I was an ambassador for Lean In. And I started making this observation that I had never really noticed before, probably because I didn't do so much public speaking, which is that whenever I spoke for 30 minutes, 40 minutes about all of these collective solutions to solving the women's leadership conundrum, every time I opened it up for the Q&A afterward, the first set of questions that I would always get were to me personal questions that didn't have anything to do with what I had just spoken about for the past 40 minutes, okay? So literally, I would say, okay, it's time for Q&A. And a woman would raise her hand eagerly and she would say, yes, yes. So my question is, you said something about your daughter who's 5 when you were talking, and then you mentioned your son who is 8, and you said something about your husband who's in Dubai right now, but you're in San Francisco with us and you live in Harlem and tomorrow you're going to be in Baltimore. I like your outfit and you seem happy and healthy and you have this career that's all about your passion and purpose. You look like you might even have time to go to the gym. And I've just been sitting here wondering, like, what the hell, you know, how are you managing it all? Okay. And that is actually the most popular question that successful women get. How do you manage it all? I would look around at the sea of women, all of whom who would be like, yeah, I don't know what she's been talking about for 40 minutes, but that's the same thing that I've been wondering this entire time. That's my question. That's what I want to know. Okay. I got this question so often that I came up with this one-liner to respond to the question. I would just say to the entire group, and keep in mind that it was often a group of largely women, just like this one. Oh, I just expect way less from myself and way more from my husband than the average woman. Okay. And I would get just enough laughs like that, that I could move people on to what I felt were much more important substantive issues, like equal pay for equal work. But one day I had what I call a Tiffany's epiphany. I literally, some people call them aha moments, which was that I was taking a step back from the podium and this voice said to me, honey, they're not asking you, how do you manage it all? Because they care so much about the details of your personal business that you don't want to disclose to everybody. They're asking you, how do you manage it all? Because they're sitting there wondering, how am I going to manage it all? And if your life's work really is advancing women and girls, then you owe women a better answer to the question than the one-liner that you came up with to get a few laughs and then to move people on to what you think is more important. At the same time, I had reached a point in my career in 2013 where I was getting a lot of requests for meetings. And if you're a senior woman in leadership, you know this experience of getting those messages. I really would like to connect with you. I'd love to learn more about your story. I'd love to get some advice about my journey and about my career. I was starting to get more and more of those. And in 2013, I decided to do something that was quite counter to my drop the ball philosophy, which was to say yes to every single woman that reached out to me. I started meeting with women on Tuesdays and Thursdays when I wasn't traveling at 9, 10, and 11 a.m. I still do it today. I've met with over 1,000 women. And it's been the most remarkable part of my professional journey and my personal journey, because it turns out that when you stop just talking to women and you stop just talking about women and you start actually sitting down and listening to women one-on-one, the reason why we don't have more women at the highest levels of leadership becomes kind of obvious. We're really, really busy. Okay. And in these meetings, one of the dynamics that I discovered was this really direct correlation between a woman's ambition, her desire to feel that she could reach the highest level of leadership, and her feeling of pressure about things that she needed to do on the home front. And what was most fascinating about this correlation is that it was irregardless of a woman's actual status. I had young women, millennial women, recent college graduates who were coming to me stressed about career decisions they are making right now in anticipation of future caregiving responsibilities that they don't even have. Do you have a boyfriend? No. Do you have a girlfriend? No. But they're making decisions now in anticipation of some future caregiving responsibility, and they just want to make sure that they've curated their career in such a way that they can have the work-life balance later on. I met with young people who were first-generation college students. Their parents had worked tirelessly for them to even be able to get a college education. And they were feeling the pressure of economic responsibility that they were, in some cases, ashamed to share with their work colleagues. They were paying their parents' rent. So their pressure was this economic pressure to care for their families. I met with women who were managing caregiving responsibilities at the other end of the spectrum. They were baby boomer women or late Gen X women who were managing taking care of parents, some of whom had become ill or incapacitated, and still taking care of children. One of the most interesting groups of women were the ones who had decided, who had made a decision that they weren't going to have children and had even communicated this to people in their lives. And I found them most interesting because it turns out that if you're a woman in our society who has decided or who doesn't have children, people think you have nothing else to do. And so they just give you work. They assume that you should stay late at the office. Sometimes the woman who would come into the booth at 9 a.m. on Tuesday who didn't have kids had done more childcare than I had done. And I have two kids, okay? Because she was given all the auntie work over the weekend. So the whole point was that a lot of women were feeling, in fact, every single one that I met were feeling this tug and this pull between work and life in a way. And what they were doing was actually really brilliant. They were hedging all of their bets and they were constantly negotiating. And that's part of the reason why they were saying, you know what? I understand theoretically where you're going with this, but I have my own well-being that I need to keep in mind. And there's only so much that I could do. And so I'm just going to kind of hover right here. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and answer this question once and for all. How do you manage it all? And I'm going to answer it in a really honest way. But one of my challenges of answering this question for me personally was that it was going to require me to share with everyone my dirty feminist secret, okay? Which was that for all of my career, I had been this very staunch advocate for women's empowerment in the public sphere. And I had particularly spent a lot of time deconstructing gender stereotypes in the workplace and in the public in order for us to move our society forward. My secret, though, was that at home, I didn't question gender stereotypes at all. In fact, at home, I was on Stepford Wife autopilot. And my Stepford Wife autopilot was made even more complicated by the fact that I had a really bad case of something that I call HCD, home control disease. This is basically when you feel that everything under your roof should be done a certain way, which is basically your way. And it manifested in all kinds of small ways that actually amounted to something big. Okay. I used to, for example, cook almost every day. I always smile when I say that now because I don't do that anymore. But what it meant was that there were always leftovers in the refrigerator. Okay. So let's say on Monday, I made meatloaf. And on Tuesday, I made fajitas. And on Wednesday, I made fried chicken. On Thursday, if I had a work event and my husband was home by himself, I would expect him to eat the meatloaf first. Okay, because I had a running expiration date for all of the leftovers that were in the refrigerator. And when I came home that night, and I looked in the refrigerator and I had seen that the chicken was gone, I would be annoyed. And he would pick up on the fact that I was annoyed. And he would say, "What's wrong, babe?" And I would say, "You ate the chicken." And he would say, "I like your chicken." And I would say, "So you don't like my meatloaf?" And he would know not to say anything after that. Okay, now, this may seem very small and insignificant, okay? The difference between meatloaf and fried chicken when we have bigger things to worry about, like equal pay for equal work, right? But what's important to know is that this HCD manifested in all kinds of other ways. I felt that all of the hangers in the closet should face the same direction. I felt that all of my towels in the linen closet should be folded a certain way. And I would host tutorials to try to teach people how to fold the towels, but they couldn't get it right. I felt that all of the mail should be retrieved from the mailbox every day, that you should recycle the advertisements and the things that you don't want, and that you should open each envelope and deal with what was inside, because if you didn't, it would pile up. And then guess who would have to manage all of that, right? Me. I especially felt that if you ever received a birthday party invitation, you should RSVP right away. Because if you didn't, number one, someone would think that you were very rude. And I used to be very concerned about people thinking that I was rude. And secondly, you might actually miss the party, okay? If you don't RSVP right away and get it on your calendar. Somehow, believe it or not, miraculously, I was able to maintain this level of HCD and to be successful in my professional life until what happened for me, which was this life-changing event of having a child. And you don't have to have kids if you've just ever been in the room with a small child. You can imagine that my HCD combined with a new child basically meant that my world went spiraling downward. Now, what I want to be really clear about is that during this time when I had a very bad case of HCD, I did not think of myself as having HCD. I did not think of myself as being on Stepford Wife autopilot. I imagined myself and thought of myself to be a very modern woman. I was very ambitious. I was very much in the driver's seat of my own life and my own journey. We were a very modern, progressive couple, even though if you had have done some kind of analysis of the household division of labor in my home in 1997 and compared it with the couple in 1950, it would have been exactly the same. We were forward-thinking and very modern and very progressive. What happened was not that I came up with some strategic philosophy about dropping the ball. What happened was that I came to a point in my life, and by the way, I've spoken to women for whom their point was something other than the birth of a child. Maybe they got a job and finally realized that being the boss is actually really difficult. Maybe they have someone who's they've just found out has been diagnosed with an illness, and now they need to become the primary caregiver. For me, it was the child. And so what happened was that the one person who had always been so obsessed with never dropping balls started dropping balls left and right. Okay? I live in New York City, where we have these stupid alternate side parking rules because you have to, they want to clean the streets like every other day. And so if you don't move your car, and it's so silly because we don't always drive our cars, but you still have to move your car for alternate side parking. And if you don't move your car, you get this bright orange citation. I don't know how many of those bright orange citations you get before someone comes to arrest you, but I am telling you, as proof of me standing here right now, it's a lot. Okay. And I discovered nobody ever comes to arrest you. Okay. No one ever called to tell me, I don't love you anymore. You're not going to be my friend anymore because you didn't do something. And so what I used to feel was dropping the ball, which was really letting people down and failing to take timely action and disappointing other people, disappointing myself, in my personal case, disappointing the entire Black race if I ever did something that was wrong. I decided to reappropriate because I started questioning, well, if I'm dropping all of these balls and Armageddon isn't really hitting, why was I so obsessed with all of these things to begin with? And so for me now, dropping the ball is really about dropping these unrealistic expectations of what it means to feel this pressure of doing it all to begin with. And I want to share with you the three balls that I learned to drop that made the most difference for me and that I actually think can make the most difference for the world. The first ball was this unrealistic expectation about who I was even supposed to be. So it turns out that all of us enter our lives playing certain roles. If you're a woman, your first role is probably daughter. If you're a man, your first role is probably son. At some point, you might become a brother or a sister if you have siblings. Certainly, we all become friends, students, eventually workers. Some of us citizens, some of us become wives, mothers, husbands, fathers. If you're an ambitious person, which by virtue of you even being at a women's conference, you likely are, then you by default put the word good in front of all of your roles, okay? And you probably did this very early on. So it's not sufficient to be a daughter. You want to be a good daughter. It's not okay just to be a student. You want to be a good student. And a good friend, and a good worker, and a good wife, and a good mother. And in my conversations with all of these women, one of the observations I've made is that even though we're born in different parts of the world, into different families, with different cultures, different values, we all seem to ascribe to the same job description for what it means to be a good anything. I'm the oldest of four girls, and in my good sister job description, it says that I need to respond to my little sister's text messages in 2 minutes. Okay, I'm sure there's one right now saying I need $100 or something. In the good mom job description, there's a line and it literally says you need to be physically present when your child takes their first steps. Okay, I cannot tell you the number of women who come into the booth, they're huffing and puffing and they're really stressed because they are scheduled to leave for some work event. And they just know that as soon as that plane takes off, their child who's about 1 year old is going to start walking. They will have missed the whole event. And that will have meant that they are a very bad mother. I can finish the story because I've heard it a million times. This is despite the fact that not one more person in this room could tell me that you remember who was there when you took your first steps. But apparently, this is a very, very important, momentous occasion in the life of a child that if you miss means that you're a very bad mom. In the job description for a good husband, a good father, there's a line that I think is really insidious. It says that you should aspire to be a breadwinner at all costs. All costs. Even the cost of meaningfully engaging with your family, even sometimes the cost of supporting the women in your lives. I think it's an insidious line because it's tied to men's masculinity. And I hope that someone writes a book about how men can drop that ball because I think it would make a big difference in the world. So I had to really explore and think about, why is it that I feel all of this pressure to do these things? And really, the job descriptions came from what I had observed largely when I was a child. Okay, my mom was a preacher's wife. Our house was always clean. Our hair was always cornrowed beautifully, okay, in the same direction with the lovely beads. I got a lot of what my job descriptions were supposed to be from popular culture. I grew up on The Cosby Show, which basically meant I was going to be Claire Huxtable. Okay? I was going to have perfectly feathered hair, perfect makeup. I would waltz into every room with this like brightly colored Eileen Fisher flowy outfit thing. My house would always be clean. I would have five perfectly well-behaved children that were all college bound. And in the second season of my life, I would make partner at a law firm. Did anyone see that episode? It was actually quite a ridiculous episode. But at that time, I didn't realize that. It wasn't until further in my drop the ball journey that I realized the idea of making partner at a law firm and having five perfectly well-behaved children probably would have been very difficult to do. So what I had to do is go from kind of just by default living out these job descriptions to recurating what my job descriptions would be. And to do that, I had to get really clear about what mattered most to me. And after a lot of soul searching and a lot of exercises, it became really clear that the most important things to me, that what mattered most were, one, advancing women and girls, surprise, surprise. Two, nurturing a really healthy partnership with my husband. And three, raising conscious global citizens. And it was really important that I came to a point where I was really clear about what mattered most to me, as opposed to all of the other expectations that I had been taught. Because the second ball that I was going to have to figure out how to drop was this unrealistic expectation about what I was supposed to do. So I used to be one of those people that had lists. I was constantly making lists. I could tell you every best app for how you organize all of your to-dos, how you prioritize them. But eventually I came to a point where I realized that what you do is far less important than the difference you make. I once did a time management workshop. Well, it was supposed to be a time management workshop with about 80 women. We actually didn't get that far because the first exercise that I asked everyone to engage in was one in which they were to imagine and then write down everything that they expected to do or complete in an ideal day. And I mean every single little thing. If you wake up in the morning and you go to the gym, write that down. If you wake up in the morning and you're just thinking about how you should be going to the gym, you gotta write that down. Okay, that takes time. If you need to get dressed, great. You eat breakfast, great. Have a pet to walk, have your commute. You might have other people to prepare for. You have meetings to prepare for, every single little thing until you can't think of anything more. And then I asked everyone to write down next to each item how long they thought it would take for them to complete each one of those items, and then to sum the total at the bottom. And as I was walking around the tables, you know how facilitators do, and I was looking down at people's pieces of paper, I was having another Tiffany's epiphany, because not one person had a sum that amounted to less than the 24 hours any of us have in a day. And half the women didn't even have sleep on their list. Okay. And they were already at the 24 hours. And I thought to myself, well, it's no wonder we're all walking around with such feelings of inadequacy, as if we're not doing enough, as if we can't get it all done. Have you ever felt that anxious? It's just kind of always under the surface. Okay. It's because you can't get it all done. What we're imagining as what we're supposed to have been accomplished in even one 24-hour period is humanly impossible. So I had to move from just accepting all of the to-dos and being kind of obsessed with just organizing them in an efficient way and strategic way to really getting clear about, well, what is my highest and best use in achieving what matters most to me? How should I be leveraging both what I can do with very little effort, not because I'm a prodigy, but because I've probably just done it a lot, with the things that only I can do in order to achieve maximum impact? And that was really important. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that I do really well with very little effort is help other people to achieve clarity through guidance and encouragement. Okay, some people would call that coaching. That's probably, if I wanted to charge everyone for these meetings on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'd probably be a very profitable coach. One of the things that only I can do in relationship to my kids and what matters most to me there is engage my kids or actually instill values in them. You know, it's very hard to outsource the installation of values in human beings. So my highest and best use in raising conscious global citizens, remember, what matters most to me isn't that they go to Harvard, that they're conscious global citizens, is engaging my kids in meaningful conversations each and every day, okay? No matter where I am. Yesterday, I was in Seattle. Today, I'm in Austin. Tomorrow, I'm in New Orleans. But every single day, I'm going to reach out to them over Skype, over FaceTime, and I'm going to try to help them to achieve clarity through guidance and encouragement. What kind of day did you create for yourself today? Who did you laugh with today? Okay, if an alien spaceship came to your school today and abducted one person, who would they have abducted? Why would they have abducted that particular person? Okay, and in that way, I can help my kids to nurture a great relationship with themselves, with the people who are around them, with their community, and hopefully the world. Does that mean that there wasn't a Halloween costume that was supposed to have been purchased before Tuesday? Sure. Does it mean that I was supposed to cook like some orange cookies for something? Sure. But I can drop the ball on any one of those things and still feel that I'm an extraordinary mother because I made sure that I did what my highest and best use was for today in order to raise those conscious global citizens. The toughest ball for me to drop in this journey was a fear of asking for help. And it's kind of ironic because I'm someone who really does love to help other people, but I used to suck at getting help myself. A lot of it was ego. It was I didn't want people to think that I was vulnerable. There was a lot of stuff going on. But one of the people that I learned to get help from, and it's kind of the crux of this particular book, because it's a little bit of a romantic comedy about how I got my husband off the couch, was my husband, Kojo. And one of the things that I delegated with joy to him was managing our kids' social calendar. Okay, this is a task that often by default falls to women, but it's actually a task that I've discovered should be managed by the person who is the social butterfly, okay, in the relationship. They actually care a lot more about this kind of stuff. And he does a really extraordinary job. He's really good at this job. The problem, though, is that our world hasn't quite yet evolved, okay, for women who have dropped the ball, for families who have evolved. And a good example is that no one ever sends a child's birthday party invitation to their dad. People always send it to the mom. It doesn't matter what your role is and how many times you've told them this is not the way your family works. Sometimes I commit when I get one of those invitations, what I feel like is this little tiny act of defiance, and I'll email it back to the person and I'll say, thank you so much for inviting Akua to the party. Her father is her calendar maven. Could you please email him at, and then I give his email address. But on most days, when I have a ton of emails that are in my inbox, I have more text messages from my little sisters telling me what they need. I have text messages or Slack messages from all of the millennials at my company. I have another billboard telling me that I need to be even skinnier and have longer hair and have bigger boobs or whatever somebody's trying to sell me. Okay. And I get that email, I get that invitation. I have to ask myself my drop the ball question, which I ask myself multiple times a day, is responding to this birthday party invitation your highest and best use in raising a conscious global citizen? The answer is often no. And so I move on. And that is how we end up with a child that is really upset and devastated because they missed the birthday party. Fortunately, my daughter, Akua, is a child who is made quite happy by one of two things. Either one of these donuts from Dunkin' Donuts, the one with the pink frosting and the sprinkles, or bacon. Basically, if you bring this child one of these donuts or bacon, it's all good. And that night, I brought her one of these donuts. I didn't feel guilty, but I have a lot of empathy, and it would really suck to miss a birthday party. I remember being in the second grade, and we talked about what happened, and we talked about her day, and I had that meaningful conversation. Now, since I've been sharing the story for a number of months now, because remember, this happened before this book actually came out. Every time at the end, I always have at least a couple of women come up to me and say, okay, I totally get the whole dropping the ball thing. I need to drop the ball. But the birthday party, I mean, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. And if that's you right now, I am just giving you a virtual hug And I want to tell you, I completely get it. It's just that for me personally, I cannot go back. I can't go back. In the 7-8 years now since I've dropped the ball, I've been able to run a national women's leadership organization that's trained thousands of women to run for office. There's a lot of anxiety about what's happening in our world right now. But I happen to know that there's an amazing, fierce pipeline of women ready to lead. You wait till this next election cycle. Okay. In that amount of time, I've been able to help grow the fastest growing network for millennial women that's helping them to elevate their careers and helping them to create lives that they're passionate about. I've been able to raise millions of dollars for nonprofit organizations that I think are doing amazing work building girls of confidence and character. I just wrapped up my term with Girl Scouts USA. I'm on the board of Girls Who Code in Simmons College. And think about it, in that amount of time, I've also had time to sit down in coffee shops and write a book about the whole thing. And if any one of those things helps to create a world in which my Akua can grow up and she can live her passion and she can live her purpose and she can do it unencumbered by all of these crazy expectations about who we're supposed to be and what we're supposed to do, then for me, it's worth it for her to miss a couple of birthday parties. Okay, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. The last thing that I want to share with you is about my mom and particularly about what my parents taught me. This is my mom, Brenda. She found out that she was pregnant with me when she was 19 years old. My parents are from Watts, LA. Suffice it to say that in the 1970s, Watts was a rough place and it was a rough time. Okay. My mother didn't know anything other than the environment that she grew up in, but she knew that there had to be something alternative. There had to be something different. She happened to have an uncle who was an army recruiter. And from what I hear, he was a very big and foreboding uncle. And between the uncle and my mom, my dad was convinced to join the army. I was born 9 months later at Fort Lewis Army Base in Tacoma, Washington. So the plan worked. The same man who had to kick a heroin addiction to even be able to pass the physical exam for the military served his country honorably. He went to college on the GI Bill. He eventually earned a PhD in theology. I grew up in a lovely house, literally with a white picket fence around it, unaware of the cycles that my parents were able to break in one generation, a cycle of poverty, a cycle of addiction, and a cycle of violence. I personally don't know those cycles. And my parents were able to do this, one, because we live in the greatest country on earth. I don't care what anybody says. And they were also able to do it based upon this fundamental truth that I want to leave you with, which is that if you want something that you've never had before, you're going to have to do something that you've never done before in order to get it. And I can tell you with certainty, it's not going to be comfortable and that it's probably going to be quite messy. But I can also tell you with confidence that it will be worth it, not just for you, but I think that it will be worth it for the world and the impact that you'll be able to create in it.
Tiffany DeFoo is the best-selling author of Drop the Ball and creator of The Crew. To learn more about Tiffany and her work, visit tiffanydefoo.com. We hope you found this session helpful and thank you for listening. We also invite you to tune in for more best breakouts from the conferences for women.